It's a very sad and quite melancholy moment for us here at the Speakeasy. It's been 18 months since we recorded our first one.
It has, maybe just a bit over that now.
Yeah.
But yeah. He's been Rob Wickings and I've been Clive Ashenden. Good night.
Good night.
No. We're going out with one last hurrah.
Yes, we kind of had a long thought about what we were doing over the Christmas break and into the new year, and we decided that the time was ripe for us to...
We gave ourselves a stern talking to.
We gave ourselves a very stern talking to. We wagged fingers and stuff at each other. And we came to the conclusion that it was time to start something new, which we will be talking about at the end of this podcast. But for now, we're...
So it's not all down, it's not all about...
No, not at all. I mean, when Clive says this is the end of this chapter, if you like. End of part one. Dramatic pause.
If you like, yes.
If you like, yeah, definitely. More news on that at the end of this, at the end of the end. We started 18 months ago, like I say, with a show that was basically me and Clive talking about music. And that's the way we want to finish off the run. So what we're doing this go-round is we're talking the art and the passion and the joy of the single.
Yes, and we're very specific about that in this sort of brief. Best singles of all time, our favourite singles of all time. So not just best songs, they must have been released as a 12-inch, a 7-inch, a cassette, CD single, or single download. So, and it's very distinct as opposed from just a song that's on an album, the single. It has its own, they have their own kind of rhythms and their own sort of art form to them. Whether you take it as the classic kind of 3-minute pop song or... You go into the kind of elaborate sort of
mini opera. Some of them can.
Yeah, your kind of
your Bohemian Rhapsodies, I suppose. Or
Bat Out of Hells.
Bat Out of Hells. Scenes from a Teenage Opera. That kind of dealy. So that I mean the Orb tried to release a single back in the mid-80s that was 39 minutes long. And I think there were only like probably about 30 seconds away from actually getting away with it as well. It's a very broad remit, is the single.
That would be interesting.
Yeah,
that'd be like the sort of like the Bel-Air film of singles.
Definitely, yeah.
So we also, as part of this, we put this kind of brief out on social media. And got you, our gentle listeners, our friends, our contributors, to pitch in with your suggestions of what you think the greatest singles are of all time.
Some interesting choices there.
There were some very interesting choices. Obviously, this is all very personal. There are no wrong answers here.
Yeah, I mean, that's the joy of it. That's certainly our picks, as you find as we go along, are deeply, deeply personal.
So, in no particular order... Actually, in the order I wrote them down.
There you go, that's a particular order.
That's kind of a particular order. We have suggestions from the likes of John Boyce, coming through with 4 suggestions in total. I'm Broken by Pantera.
Ooh.
Loser by Beck. New Rose by The Damned. And his 21st century suggestion is I'm Shipping Up to Boston by Dropkick Murphys. You are fantastic.
Nicely punky, and nice to see some Pantera in there as well. That's that whole sort of bitey southern metal. It's always good.
Absolutely.
But New Rose, yeah, all over that. It's such a fantastic 2-minute head rush of a record.
Keeping it metal for a moment, Mark Brown of Brainhound Films fame, or should that be Infamy?
Both.
Gives us a simple one pick, Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter by Iron Maiden.
Absolutely right, fantastic stuff. They're one and only number one single as well.
Yes, shockingly, they're one and only number one single. You know, I don't think it's my favourite Maiden song. I think I said at the time, I mean, I've Run to the Hills or...
Yeah. Number of the Beast for me.
Yeah, I mean, there are loads of great ones. But, you know, it's a really good single, so, right?
Yeah.
What else do we have? We have Antonio Maguire. It's just Like Heaven by The Cure.
Ah, good pick. I also like the Dinosaur Jr. version, which I've got on, and is a very heavily etched 12-inch.
I don't know that I know that version.
It's a very good version. It's very Dinosaur Jr.-y.
Yeah. Like that. And The Cure are definitely one of those bands who are a great singles band.
Completely.
And, you know, there are a lot of my favourite bands that I love, and I wouldn't necessarily describe them as singles bands, if you know what I mean. But there are other bands like The Cure, like The Smiths, like Pet Shop Boys, where you immediately... You think of the singles first.
Their strongest album is always the singles compilation, weirdly enough.
Yeah, or their B-sides.
Their B-sides, yeah. Well, I mean, the best Oasis album is The Master Plan, which is their B-sides album.
Yeah. So, carrying on down the list, Mr. James O'Shea, the Scourge of Social Media.
Oh, God bless him.
Gives us Ace of Spades by Motorhead, which is just fantastic, isn't it?
You can't go wrong with that one. That very nearly made it into my top five.
It was on my long list, I have to say.
Yeah.
And then Blue Monday, The Order, obviously best-selling 12-inch of all time.
Yeah.
And The Man with a Child in His Eyes by Kate Bush.
Oh, good choice. Nice bit of drama in there as well.
Absolutely. So, yeah, so a nice breadth of choices there. And speaking of breadth of choices, we have Mr. Ben Woodywiss.
Writer, filmmaker, auteur, all-round cineast.
All-round good egg.
That's the guy.
Yep. His picks are Rope for Luck by Happy Monday, specifically the 12-inch extended version.
Ah, okay. So
it's very specific.
Interesting
about
that he did specify that. I think probably because it's actually better to dance to, that one. It's the one that you really can get your long-armed lope onto.
Oh, we love a long-armed lope. Then The Israelites by Desmond Dekker.
Oh, me Israelite.
I should point out at this point maybe that this is not a dry podcast. It's our last one ever, so we have some wine going on here. So there may be singing, there may be crying, there may be stuttering, there may be all kinds of messiness, but there will be lots of talking about our favourite songs, singles, Nate.
Yes.
And then he finishes his picks off with I'm Waiting for the Man by The Velvet Underground and Nico, although she's not on that one, is she?
No, she's on the album. She's on the album, but
she is, but not on that. And then... Last but certainly not least, we have actor Andrew Lorden.
Actor Andrew Lorden! Hello, Andrew.
Yes. Hello, Andrew. And he's very... initially I thought he was only going to pick Australian artists from the 1980s.
Men at Work?
I was hoping for some Men at Work, but no.
No Men at Work!
Sadly not. So we have... The Stock Aitken and Waterman produced a duo, Kylie Minogue and Jason Donovan, with Especially For You, which is what one of those songs where no matter what you think of it, it absolutely nails down like a period in time. You can probably remember, if not what you're doing when you heard this, but you know, where you were at the time in your life.
Yeah,
just because it was so ubiquitous.
Very clear picture of that.
And his other Australian entry is All Out of Love by Air Supply.
Ooh.
So a little bit of soft rock classics there. And then he finishes his choices off with What a Fool Believes by the Doobie Brothers.
Good choice. Love the Doobies. Choice. Love Michael McDonald's voice.
Yeah. So, and that, I think, is that. Apologies if we've missed anyone else. I did try and trawl through various different threads that we had going.
Mm-hmm.
I will also say a big thank you to Willie Harlow, who suggested that we should also do a podcast about songs that we think should have been singles instead of the ones that were. So we might talk about that in tonight in our discussion, but I'm not sure we'll get
it's a tricky one. Let's just briefly touch on that now. That's quite a tricky one because it is really a personal kind of... I mean, one that you could potentially mention would be Side 2 of Abbey Road by the Beatles as one big single because it does work as a whole collective piece, even though you can pull individual songs out of it.
I'd push back against that. I think that sort of counter the idea of a single.
Oh, okay.
If you see what I mean.
Yeah, okay.
But, yeah, I mean, there are sometimes you think, I mean, I'm sort of throwing forward to my choices here, but there's one of my choices here where it's the third single off the album, and it's so clearly a hit single. You're like, why? What, you know? And you look at the songs that they put out before this, which weren't hits, and you just think that someone had a brain melt, you know?
Yeah.
Or they just overthought it, you know? They're like, oh, that one's a bit like the one we had the hit with before, or something.
Yeah, so maybe let's just hold back on that one. It could just be they wanted to keep the powder dry. Maybe they were coming up for Christmas or something like that, thinking, wham.
In this case, I don't think so, but we'll...
okay.
So, there's lots of interesting comments and people talking about why things were their favourite or what they particularly liked about certain tracks. Or just popping a link down there, that also worked.
Yeah.
Andrew did threaten to sing his versions of his songs, but we haven't received any MP3s. I think that might be a kindness. No offense, Andrew. I know you're musical theatre trained, but you know, we're all going to start singing at some point.
I'm disappointed, Andrew. I have to say, I was really looking forward to hearing those. But you know, it's not too late. We could always bop it in as a extra. So if you're listening, give us a tune.
Yeah, so one of the others I'll pick out is James O'Shea, who does obviously like to stir the pot.
He does, doesn't he?
God bless him.
Yeah.
He made the comment, why do I have the suspicion that not a single song that we choose will be made after 2005?
Well, in my case, it's absolutely right.
And in my case, it's absolutely right as well. I mean, that's an interesting one because I suggested on the thread that I thought that a lot of these, I think with our favourite songs, you tend to imprint on them at an early age.
Yeah, very much so.
Or at least at certain kind of key moments in your life.
There's a very definite sweet spot, I think, for when you grab those songs that are going to be meaningful to you for the rest of your life.
Although, having said that, one of my choices has become more meaningful to me, if you see what I mean, which is why it's broken into the top five.
Okay.
So, I don't know, so it can change, but, I mean, I in my sort of long list, in order to get to five, I ended up with about 30, I think.
You surprised me.
Yeah, so that's how I roll. I'll list the sort of ones I have after 2005, which I thought about including. So I had Buy Nothing Day by the Go Team.
Okay.
The Go Team are a fantastic singles band, and I'm pleased to say they're sort of back together again.
Oh,
well,
okay.
Or have been reactivated, because it's largely the sort of work of one guy, I think, behind the scenes, and various different guest artists. But they're just fantastic. And also had Outkast, Hey Ya.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, that's 2003, so there we go. What else do we have that's more?
That's 12 years old.
I know, it's scary. It's like,
God.
You know, I'm writing sort of these ones down, and you look at the date, and you're like, wow, Beyonce, Crazy in Love, 2003 as well.
Really?
Yeah.
Grave.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah.
So the other more recent ones I had were Fleet Foxes' White Winter Hymnal, which I love. And this one that probably came closest to breaking in was Get Lucky by Daft Punk.
Yeah,
featuring Pharrell Williams and obviously Nile Rodgers. And, you know, I mean, if we were making lists kind of based on, you know, how influential tracks were, what the most important singles were, then obviously, you know, you'd have Sex Pistols in there, but you'd have some Chic in there, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think you'd have to.
You know, it's just, but the thing is, I wouldn't assume, and spoiler, I haven't put any Chic in my top five, not because I don't love Chic, and they're great to dance to, but if I was going to put one in there, I probably would put Get Lucky, because it's everything I love about Chic, but modern,
yeah,
if that makes sense,
yeah.
You know, and it has all the kind of, you know, wonderful electronic giddiness of Daft Punk. So there we go.
Indeed.
So yeah, so you're right, James.
Yeah, Fred. I mean, I'm unabashed about that. You know, you're completely right. But to my mind, the singles that I've chosen are the ones that are most meaningful to me, and nothing has sprung to mind probably post 1995 that's as meaningful as these songs. So for my sins, yeah, I'm an old crusty, so.
Okay. Well, I think without further ado, we'll thank everyone who contributed on social media.
Thank you very much for making the time, guys. Much appreciated.
Thank you. And now we will go straight into it. And Rob, I will let you kick us off.
Well, before we start properly, let's kind of define our terms a little bit more and talk about what does make a great single.
Okay, is this where we justify our choices a little bit?
Yeah, I'm still smarting a bit over that sort of post-2005 comment. So I've noted down 4 points, which have kind of served as a framework for what I've chosen. Number one being immediacy. You know exactly where you stand from 5 seconds or so of that track starting. So to my mind, a really great single will always have that hook, that immediate bam. You know,
the intro. You can't underestimate the value of a great intro that hooks you immediately.
Mm.
I mean, I can think of singles I like which kind of beguile you in, you know, and then hit you in the chorus. If you sort of mean,
yeah.
Where you sort of like, oh, what's this? And then they hit you in the back of the head with the hook.
Yeah,
but often the great ones, they just go for the throat straight away.
Yeah, absolutely.
Know? It's that old kind of, especially with the old with songs from the 50s and 60s, where they literally had to go around the radio stations, play for the DJ, and they maybe you had, if you're lucky, 30 seconds before they tell you to F off, you know, unless you had some payola going.
Yeah, it's kind of like the audio equivalent of the whole sort of first page test of a book. You read that first page, and if it doesn't grab you, then back on the shelf it goes, go find something else.
Absolutely.
That kind of deal. Tied into that is the whole notion of the riff. A lot of really great singles have a really great riff at the heart of them, and obviously that riff goes through the song, but it's what...
Yeah, and it doesn't necessarily have to mean a guitar riff, although often it does, but it can be like a piano figure. It can be like, a repeated, could be a synthesizer bit. Horns.
Yeah, when I say riff, what I basically mean is a sort of repeated musical figure that starts a song off and kind of acts as its backbone, really. But again, simplest is bestest. Two examples, Back in Black, 3 notes, really. I mean, it's chords, but it's still like bap, 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 3 notes.
Yeah,
Tainted Love, two notes. I mean, you've got that sort of walking bass line, but to me, the riff of Tainted Love is that bang, bang.
Yeah, I mean, the one example I kept coming back to, which hasn't made my top five, so I'm citing it now, is the opening, and this is a riff opening, is the opening to You Really Got Me by the Kinks.
Yeah.
You know, da-na-na-na-na-na.
Yeah.
Da-na-na-na-na. And it's just straight away, and you get that, and then the drums hit,
yeah.
And then you're in, you know.
Yeah.
And the amount of rock songs that basically follow that template.
Yeah. Well, it's not just rock songs that do that. There's one of my picks I'll talk about does exactly that as well. That's that whole sort of thing. But, yeah, definitely that whole sort of immediacy, the riff is important. And emotion as well. Great singles really do make you feel something. They're all about hooking into those primal feelings that we all have. It's all about love, and a lot of times it's quite negative as well. You know, the great single will make you feel something, even if that something is bad. I hunger for your love, oh my darling, I hunger for your love. She's gone. It's over. Love will tear us apart. That kind of stuff, but it's really simple, primal stuff. You don't get too many big hit singles that are about quantum physics.
Yeah. And it's the great single has I think has specificity of emotion. You know, if whatever mood you're in, and now with things like Spotify and different playlisters and so on, you can playlist your mood, can't you?
Oh, absolutely. And absolutely. I do.
You know, and not just like today I'm in the mood to hear, you know, sort of ska and reggae only, because maybe you are, mm-hmm. but specific emotional mood, you know, so if you're feeling angry, there are lots of angry songs.
Yeah.
There are loads of just specifically breakup songs. There are loads of I want you songs.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, there are loads of I've just fallen in love with someone songs. You know, so there are, you get that specific. There are my boyfriend's just died in a motorcycle accident songs. You know.
Do I have a song for you? But there's a whole other discussion to be had as to why, when we're feeling sad, we gravitate towards sad songs, as opposed to, you're feeling sad, why don't you try and make yourself happy by putting something happy on?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there are some sort of genres where I think that doesn't necessarily apply. You know, it's like, I know a lot of people who find metal relaxing to listen to.
Okay.
If you see what I mean.
Yeah.
And the actual music itself is the opposite of relaxing.
Yeah.
But there's something about, because the world is very much like, the whole time.
Mm.
So then if you put something on which is all, even more like that, then it sort of helps you. Helps you to sort of just kind of take a breath, if you see what I mean.
I
personally don't use metal that way. I tend to use it to jump up and down to and thrash my head around. Just go nuts. But it's like, you know, I've spoken to people who will put it on just to sort of chill out to, and I find that strange. But I sort of understand it, you know. It's sort of, it's just sort of, it's like having a thunderstorm in the background, you know.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah, that can be relaxing, I suppose. my last point before we move on is, and James O'Shea, this is for you. I view singles as very much being Proustian items. They're very much, for me, about...
They're very much all in French for you, all your choices.
Yes, yeah. And they come in many, many volumes. They're snapshots, they're memories, they're a form of shorthand to a particular moment. Well, they can be, anyway. You know, a snapshot to a moment, a time, a memory. They're just a quick way of getting back to somewhere where you felt particularly one way or another. And I think whether they're songs that made you feel happy at the time or made you feel sad at the time.
Yeah, or perhaps, you know, it's the song you danced to at your wedding.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's the song you remember was playing when you had your first kiss at the school disco. Perhaps it's, you know, it was your favourite single, and then you broke it because you threw it across the room in a fit of rage at the departing figure of your ex as they were walking out the door.
Yeah, maybe it was the first song that was playing when you came up on that first E that time. Who knows? It's that kind of thing, really. The great singles are the ones that stick with you for whatever reason and take you back to a particular time.
I didn't think of the first theme one. I could have put a drug inspired choice in there from my student days.
Oh, okay.
But I won't.
You won't. Okay.
I'm not going to add that in there.
All right. Okay. But if you ask nicely enough, we might stick that in as an added extra. But that's up to you, listenership. We need to hear from you if you want to hear that one. So let's, with those in mind, and I appreciate that's probably not the way some people view singles, but it's certainly the way I view singles, and it's the way we're doing this podcast, so let's have our first choices. Mr. Clive, you go first.
Okay. I've decided for no particular reason to go in chronological order with my choices. So my first pick is from 1966. And when you're talking about great singles, it's really hard to look past Motown in terms of like just the sheer number of great singles that they produce. And they were really about the singles. You know, it's only kind of when you start to get into the 70s where it starts to become more about the album. And I mean, and that's kind of true of a lot of 60s artists, I think, but particularly with Motown and the different soul labels.
Yeah, I think because they were always working towards the dance floor, so, you know, albums just don't work that well.
So my first pick is Reach Out, I'll Be There by the Four Tops.
Beautiful choice.
Or if you prefer, Reach Out, brackets, I'll Be There, close brackets by the Four Tops. I've seen it written both ways. B-side was I'm Not Satisfied. This one was a monster on its first release. It number one on both the Billboard chart and the Rhythm and Blues chart in the States, and that was number one in the UK. Written and produced by Motown's main production team of Holland Dozier Holland, you know, the monster hit makers, and, you know, or instrumentation by the Funk Brothers. So, you know, you can't really get much better than that. It's... And why have I picked this? I mean, apart from that, it's a great single and a great example of what makes a great single, I think. This is one of those songs where I, you know, this was on like the first mixtape I ever made.
Oh, now mixtapes are a whole other thing.
They are, aren't they? But when I think of the first, I can probably bring to mind a few songs that were on that. The rest of them are a bit of a haze, but... That one was, and whenever I sort of would make mixtapes, that would pretty much without fail end up on that, on the mixtape, because there was never a time I don't want to hear that song.
Well, no, that's fair enough.
You see what I mean?
Yeah, completely.
I just love it to pieces. I mean, and the main reason is, I think, is Levi Stubbs, the lead singer. On this track,
just one of the most remarkable voices in pop music.
It's just utterly unique. I mean, the vocal blend of the Four Tops is great anyway. But then when you add on top of that Levi Stubbs and this signature vocal style that together with Holland Dozier Holland that they developed, I think the first track they really sort of that you know, you really hear that on is sort of 1965's I Can't Help Myself, Sugar Pie, Honey Bunch, where you first start to hear this particular vocal style, and it's sort of, I heard it described as kind of, it's straddling, shouting and singing, which is a harsh way of putting it. You know, I'm going to read a quote now from an article that was in The Guardian from Abdul Duke Fakir, one of the singers, where he describes how they evolved this singing style, and he says Eddie Holland, one of Holland Dozier Holland, realized that when Levi hit the top of his vocal range, it sounded like someone hurting. So he made him sing right out there. Levi complained, but we knew he loved it. Every time they thought he was at the top, he would reach a little further until you could hear the tears in his voice. That's key. It's the emotion. And interesting, the line, just look over your shoulder, was something he threw in spontaneously in the take. And he says, Levi's very creative like that, always adding something extra from the heart.
Yeah.
And it's that, it's such a heartfelt sort of hurting song, you know. It's like, I'll always be there for you, but it's also a kind of like a, I love you, notice me.
Yeah,
song,
definitely.
Isn't it?
It's a real flag wave for that one. Just, it is kind of like, here I am.
It's like, I love you and my love is absolutely real. I feel this thing for you and I won't let you down. I know you've, it's that message of, I know you've been hurt before. I'm not like those other guys, honestly. No, but it's absolutely, but you have no doubt of its sincerity
when you hear
it. It's also got a really kind of nice little neat kind of instrumental hook before we even get the vocals come in, which is almost like a count in, like a 1, 2, 3, 4, and then it goes. And it's sort of, it's very kind of simple. It doesn't, and then it's got this kind of just unremitting kind of groove to it. It goes on completely to the end and then it's done. And
you're done as well.
It just, it really just takes you on an emotional journey. Yeah. So I don't necessarily have a particular Proustian moment with this one. But
dang it, that goes my framework right in frame one.
But I do with definitely with some of my other choices. But okay, like I say, with this one, it's just, you know, it's kind of just always been one of my go-to songs. And when, you know, we talked about this, I sat down and I wrote down 4 songs immediately, like that I loved, and then I scribbled one of them out because criminally it was never a single. And then I had to think of some more. Then the list went crazy. Mm. But this is one of the first 3 I wrote down. Love this song to pieces. Rob.
Well, my first choice, well, all of my choices pretty much do have, as I've said, this very sort of Proustian connection. They're very much attached to either key moments in my life or moments when I realised something about myself or my relation to music, if you will. My first choice is the first single from The Smiths, This Charming Man.
Well, you know, great singles band.
Absolutely, as we mentioned before. It's one of those tracks that kind of takes a couple of listens just to get your head around what's being talked about as well, because it almost has this bizarre tumble of imagery when it first starts up. You know, punctured bicycle on a hillside, desolate, will nature make a man of me yet? It almost sounds more like something that, Wordsworth would write or something like that. It's not pop imagery at all.
And it's the marriage, isn't it? If you're going to pick a Smith song, I mean, I came close to putting How Soon Is Now on.
Yeah, I think that would have been a lot of people's choices.
But in a way, this is like the perfect marriage between Morrissey and Marr.
Yeah.
In terms of what they're bringing to the song. I think How Soon Is Now, like Marr, it's Marr's song. The hook is absolutely monster.
Yeah.
In this one, you've got the jangling, beautiful guitar riff that just drives the whole thing.
Yeah, but incredibly complex as well. I was talking about simplicity before, and this is, it's not simple. You try playing that on the guitar.
Well, it's you get used to the idea that, oh yeah, guitar riff, great guitar riff. You think of something almost that's like a bludgeon that's brutal.
Yeah.
Because and some of the great guitarists are like that.
Well,
you know?
Again, yeah, Back in Black, You Really Got Me Again.
The term Axemen really applies. Yeah. But Johnny Marr is an artist on this. It's sensitive, which is not something you think of when you think of like guitar riffs, but you get that. And then you put it together with Morrissey's lyrics and him just, and Morrissey being Morrissey.
Yeah, absolutely. The story for me behind this, I heard this for the first time when I was off school, ill for reasons I can't quite remember now, some sort of unspecified boy lurgy that I had at the time. I was at that sort of age where weird things start happening to boys and they get a little bit freaked out by it. And at that point was when this really blew up and it was being played on the radio all the time. And I made my mum go out and buy the record, bring the single back. I was like, I have to have this. And just played the hell out of it. Came back to school, raving about it. And it was, I completely blanked. No one else thought anything of it. It was just like, oh, it's the, no, I don't like that at all. And it was a real sort of weird kind of epiphany for me. Just loving this song that no one else had any sort of time for at all. And, you know, at the time, obviously, everyone was watching Top of the Pops. Everyone was listening to Radio 1. Everyone had kind of opinions. But to have a song that everyone seemed to be completely polarized against, except me, and I was just absolutely gobsmacked by that. Because as soon as I heard that song for the first time, I said, I love this. This is just such a perfect gem of a record. And that was kind of a little bit of a weird kind of head turner for me. I was always a bit of an outsider at school anyway, and this kind of almost confirmed that to a certain extent for me. Just that whole notion of music, a love of a particular kind of music can label you in a particular way. That's kind of why I like it, really, because it, even now it has that slight kind of edge to it. And you mention the Smiths to a lot of people, and they'll be like, oh, no, I don't like them at all. Whereas they've always been a band that, for me, has just had the, you know, they've always taken risks, but taken them in ways that a lot of people just wouldn't.
Yeah, and it's worth pointing out now to people, you know, especially if you're listening to this and you know, perhaps you were born in the 90s, perhaps, you know, that you weren't around at the time, or you were too young to be into the Smiths when they first came out.
Mm.
And I'd say I came to Smiths slightly later.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a little bit younger than you. I came to them, you know, in college and sort of discovered them there. But this was a time when indie music, that term actually meant something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, I always think of myself as someone who's into indie stuff, but really we're talking about just alternative when we say that now. It's become a generic term.
Mm.
But then it was very specifically about bands that were from independent record labels, and it just so happened that a lot of those bands had a certain kind of new wave sound in the 1980s.
Yeah,
you know?
There's that sort of catch-all term, the sort of jangly guitar bit. Yeah, you know, a lot of stuff played on Rickenbackers and had that kind of very trebly kind of sound. It didn't sound like your standard rock by any means.
Absolutely, and. Yeah, and it's funny, the Smiths still do mean something very deep to a lot of people,
mm.
you know. Number two.
Number two for Clive is...
So, continuing my chronological tour through
You're
the ages.
You're so organised.
Don't worry, we're now into the 1970s.
Good Lord, things move on.
I know. This single. How much wine have I had already?
Not enough.
Do you think? Okay. So this was originally on an album which came out in 1971, but wasn't released as a single until 1973 off the back of this singer's popularity in the sort of glam rock heyday.
Okay.
And the single is Life on Mars by David Bowie.
Ah.
And which was released with the B-side, The Man Who Sold the World, that's a double A-side.
Yeah,
that's a bit of awesome. And that hit number three in the UK charts. It wasn't released as a single in the US, so it took some time for sort of Dave Bowie to cross into America. And wow, where do I begin with Life on Mars? I think it's worth pointing out that it's Life on Mars ? And the question mark is so important.
Yeah.
I love this song. It's very difficult to pick a favourite David Bowie song. I almost went with Heroes, but to be honest, this one means more to me personally.
Mm.
So I ended up falling on the side of Life on Mars. Hunky Dory is probably my favourite David Bowie album. And so it's one of those ones where do I think of it as a single? But I think I do. There are a lot of my favourite songs which didn't make the list because I find it, you know, even though they were singles, because in my mind I associate them so strongly with a particular album. Or I think of those artists as album artists, and even if that song was released as a single, it seems sort of wrong to sort of pull it out as a single.
Yeah.
Because I don't have that association with it.
Okay.
So, you know, so for instance, like Talk Talk, I love. But my favourite Talk Talk songs, I can't pull them out of the Spirit of Eden album.
Yeah, that's very much of a single piece, actually.
It's just, it seems wrong, you know.
It actually seems wrong listening to it on vinyl now, because having to flip it in the middle just doesn't quite work anymore. It does almost need to be listened to as a single piece.
Yeah. So, Life on Mars is a very strange beast. It's, I mean, you know, it's glam rock, it's art rock, it's symphonic pop. Guest piano from Mr. Rick Wakeman.
Ah, my prog hero.
Yeah, prog hero. And we also have a fantastic string arrangement from Mick Ronson of Spiders from Mars fame. It's an interesting one because it's sort of, nobody delivers it as like a passionate torch song. And you've got this absolutely beautiful melody running throughout it, this symphonic kind of lushness. But the lyrics are this surreal collage of sort of bizarre vignettes. Some of which are even, you know, so you've got the combined sort of comic imagery of something like Mickey Mouse has grown up a cow. And sort of political observation about things that are going on in the streets in early 1970s, you know. Take a look at the lawman beating up the wrong guy. And he uses this kind of William Burroughs sort of cut-up technique, you know, with the whole thing.
Which I've used more and more as time goes on anyway.
Absolutely.
Did he actually use the cut-up for this one?
It feels like it. The song is definitely constructed that way. I mean, Dobo almost comes on like the sort of MC from Cabaret. It sort of offers up these scenes and asks you to make sense of them. You know, you've got this. You've kind of got a through character in this sort of sensitive young girl going to the cinema to escape an abusive home life, and being assaulted with all these different images from the media. So the question is, is this almost like a kind of memento style film where we're getting things shown to us out of order and having to, you know, are these images we're seeing, are they film that this character is watching? Is she remembering things? Are we cutting away?
Well, it's possible. I mean, you bear in mind what would have been shown in the cinema around 1971 anyway. It would have been, before the main event, you'd have had a newsreel, you'd have had a cartoon, you'd have had lots of bits and pieces. So it's possible that that's kind of what we're keying into here.
You know, it's not just that, you know, I'm not just... If it was just a series of sort of strange vignettes, then I wouldn't be talking about this as a great single. He doesn't just sort of give you this kind of anthology of imagery, which is great poetic stuff, but it sort of draws you in and makes you emotionally invest in these characters and these things. And this sort of life, and the refrain, Life on Mars, you know, what does that actually mean?
Well, it's the ultimate getaway, isn't it? When you're talking about escape, what could be...
You're talking about humanity making the same mistakes over and over again. It's almost like a torch song for kind of humanity. And it's sung with love. It's like, they're doing this again.
Yeah, he does
look
have
at
an
these horrible
extraordinary
things.
Delivery all the way through.
He's so forceful and kind of... But at the same time, there's a kind of tenderness to it. And he absolutely believes it, you know. Is there life on Mars? Is there like hope that we can get through this? You know, is there something beyond this day-to-day mire that we're in. You know, it's, but when you come down to it, you know, the sort of the melody just gets you. I mean, allegedly this started out as a parody of My Way, the Frank Sinatra song, apparently. And if you hear it, you can sort of, you know, kind of see it, but if it is, it's you know, it's like My Way reflected in like a you know, a fairground mirror. It's distorted, and it's, you know, it's changed into something completely different. I love this song, and you know, this is one of those, you know, one of a couple of sort of picks I've got here, which is ones where I have my sort of personal connection to it. Apart from that, I just have always, it's always been one of my favourites. It's a song that I like singing on SingStar.
That's it. I've never seen you do that, and that would be really something to see.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to have a SingStar evening if you want to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, we will come back to this point, but being able to sort of get a rating of SingStar on Easy does not mean you can sing. Okay, folks. So don't go, you know, don't go applying for The Voice or Brit's Got Talent or any of those X Factor, anything like that.
Even
just
though,
because you think, oh, look, oh, even if, you know, your family are going, oh, you're so good at that SingStar, you can always do it. Just be able to sort of vaguely hit the right note. You know, you might be singing it, but you're probably singing it flat. You know. Anyway. It's a great one to sing because you can really belt it out and
yeah.
With feeling.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah.
Love Life on Mars by David Bowie. Only number 3 in the UK charts.
Really?
Premier League.
Do we know what beat it to number 1?
We don't. I don't want to know because it would make me upset.
Fair enough.
No matter what it is, it's probably something horribly. Yeah, anyway, I won't go there.
Okay, fine. That's not depressing.
No, let's talk about positive things. Rob, what is your amazing number 2?
Talking about positive things, I'm going to talk about the song that was the first dance at my wedding.
Oh, fantastic.
Which is Guns N' Roses' Sweet Child of Mine. Slightly unusual choice, I know, but it was...
Was it a fast dance?
Yeah. We didn't do a slow dance at all. Our wedding was slightly... best way of putting this, unusual in that the reception just took place in Claire's mum's back garden, the marquee, and we just basically set up mixtapes and just went for it.
Oh, fantastic.
But we did have very specific ideas as to what the first couple of dances should be, and Guns N' Roses' Sweet Child of Mine was the first one. It was a song that we loved as students. When we first got together, we always danced to it. And it just seemed to make a perfect choice because it is just such an amazing love song. You think about Guns N' Roses. This was the song that broke them. But really, they came to power, if you like, as a band that were chroniclers of a particularly seedy side of LA and the LA rock scene, the whole notion of... Welcome to the Jungle and
that's absolutely, yeah.
Paradise City and that sort of thing. So you've got that whole kind of down and dirty, kind of just really deeply seedy, unpleasant thing going on. And then in the middle of it, you have this extraordinary piece of work that is just so pure. And just even though it is still an absolute kick-ass rock song with an absolutely kick-ass riff all the way through
absolutely,
it,
yeah.
It's still just got this... beautiful through line of just absolutely pure love all the way through it, which really just makes it just the greatest song for a wedding. Even so, when you consider that, there's still a hint of darkness and a hint of doubt at the end of it, which just made it so perfect for us. You know, how do you start a wedding on a dance floor, dancing away each other and singing, "Where do we go now? We go."
Fantastic.
That kind of moment.
And of course, you know, picking November Rain has poor connotations when you think of the video as well.
Yeah, but that was choice number 6, but no, we decided not to go there in the end. Every time we play it, kids, you know, we end up sort of whirling around the house still 20 years from that start point. So for that, if for nothing else, but the fact that it is such a joy to listen to, and really thematically such a weird twist away from everything else that's on that.
I think it's some musical genres kind of get mired in the kind of in the visual of them.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
They're
so wedded to a particular time, and then we move past that time, and then suddenly everyone's very sneery and like, "Oh my god, I can't believe people used to dress like this." So that's very true. I think of that sort of hair metal scene.
Definitely.
But this is a great song, and we're talking about great singles here. We're not talking about, although you might. When you listen to it, you might have the video in mind. You might have, you know, the sort of the sheer excess of their image. You know, the massive hair with the highlights and
the hat.
The hat, the bandanas, the whole bit. You know, and it's always going to be the case that whatever comes after is going to be a reaction to what comes before.
Yeah.
So, you know, and this sort of like music critic idea that, well, you know, Nirvana killed hair metal, you know, and after that they were completely irrelevant. Well, maybe there's a certain amount of truth in that, but it doesn't, you know, I love both Nirvana and Guns N' Roses.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that, you know. But it's that thing of maybe certain people sneer at certain types of music because, oh my god, what are they wearing, you know, and especially if you weren't around at the time and you're just sort of experiencing it
as a video
then it's like, oh, what is this, you know, oh, I can't believe this, you know, what did you used to dress like that then, you know, it gets, you know, it gets mired in that thing, especially in the video age. Especially now we're talking about sort of songs from the '80s.
Yeah.
Are there any of your songs that aren't from the '80s, Rob? Actually, there is.
Yes, there is. Yeah, my next point, my next choice, actually.
Cool. But
probably not.
A lot of these, they have that kind of visual component. Some of them they bring to mind. I mean, even Life on Mars had a great music video. So sometimes you just bring those images to mind, but I think it's worth pointing out that this is great singles we're talking about here.
And this is
not great videos. It's not great, you know. It's not the whole thing.
Yeah.
And you know, well, actually, that sort of leads on nicely to my next pick.
Segway beautifully.
Segway.
Five segway into.
I segue into my next pick, which is a group, again from the 70s, and this is a group that I think they had such a particular visual identity that's so identified with the 70s, and it has a kind of kitsch value to it now, and it's been sort of adopted by certain, you know, ironically, you know, and it's kind of, I think it's slightly kind of muddied their legacy.
It's your waddy waddy, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right, it's mud. No.
That's neat.
That's sweet, isn't it? No, this is... okay, Rob, I'm going to give you a clue so you can guess this. Right?
Go on, then.
You've probably just seen my notes there.
No, I haven't, actually.
So. Okay, right. So, okay, to my knowledge, the only UK number one single in which both the group and the song title are a palindrome.
Oh.
That means it's the same.
I know what a palindrome is.
I'm explaining to our listeners to you, you know.
Same backwards as forwards.
Uh-huh.
Oh, God. No, go on, you've got me.
Okay. ABBA.
ABBA.
And SOS.
Oh, beautifully called.
So, yes, 1975, B-side, Man in the Middle. This is the song I was referring to earlier in the podcast when I was talking about... This is the third single from their self-titled 1975 album. The previous two singles were quite frankly, just album tracks. You know, they were poor and they did not hit at all. Now,
see, it's bizarre when you think of someone like the quintessential.
And also, yeah, you think of them there, but this, you got to think where ABBA are in their career at this point. They've had their breakthrough Eurovision winner Waterloo in, you know, I think a year or two before that.
Yeah.
And they've had, and nothing has hit since. So they've now brought out this new album, and both their first two singles have, if not bombed, they've just not done, they've
much.
Not broken through. So this, their third single, becomes their first worldwide hit since Waterloo, and sort of cements them as like not just like a one-hit wonder.
Mm.
And after that, you get your Mamma Mia's, you get your Dancing Queens, you get everything, you know. And they just become this sort of, this phenomena, you know. So, because 1975, 76 is really the peak of ABBA mania.
Yeah, yeah.
It just takes off from this point.
Yeah. I was there, I remember it.
I was so, at one point I was really tempted just to make a point to pick a top five of just ABBA singles, because I love ABBA.
Yeah.
And
I think you'd be perfectly justified in doing that.
And
well.
I think I could do that without putting any filler in there, even, or, you know, or ones which are just sort of second tier. I think they're just absolutely great. But going back to this idea of sort of image, you know, you've got the image, you know, of them in their Eurovision gear, or in their sort of disco sort of heyday. The sort of, the, you know, the cheesy smiles, the group of them, you know, you've got the keyboard player who sort of, they seem to have based, you know, Rolf from the Muppets on, you know. And it's sort of, and then the way it's been sort of, it's now sort of more, it's been sort of adopted by Mamma Mia, the stage show, so it's now this sort of almost like chick lit sort of appropriated thing. Plus, I mean, you know, God bless the sort of, you know, like gay discos, because they knew this was great dance floor filler stuff from the word go, you know, ABBA, and there's always been a certain gay following for ABBA.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's a certain stigma to saying that as a straight man that you love ABBA, even now that people recognise how great these songs are, because they're sort of seen as being slightly kitschy, and pop still has this stigma in certain circles of music journalism of being
ephemeral,
throwaway,
ephemeral,
as being not as important as rock,
yeah,
which is rubbish.
Yeah, bobbins,
absolutely rubbish. Because it is so difficult to write a great pop single, but when you do, they absolutely cut through to the meat of it.
Yeah.
And
I mean, I think, again, that's probably why ABBA are so strong, because they do, they tick a lot, all the boxes in our framework that we set up earlier. They're very much about dealing with the primal stuff, the basic stuff. They're about love. More importantly, towards the end of the career, the breakout.
Absolutely. And I think I picked this one for me because it's sort of on the balance. I was close to picking Dancing Queen, because you can't really, that's maybe one of the most uplifting songs ever written.
Yeah.
And it's just, apart from that, it's great to dance to. It's literally about the rush of what it is like to dance, what it is like to see someone that you fancy across the dance floor, to dance with them, to make that move, to feel that rush of being young. It is all about that. It's absolutely joyous. SOS is a different kind of song. SOS is about love, but it's about the heartache of love. And more as, you know, as they go through their career, ABBA, they always have this kind of Bergman-esque, almost Swedish melancholy sort of strand to their pop. The melodies are always absolutely killer and always have that slight uplifting thing to them. Even if there's like a counter melody which is ominous, perhaps, you know.
It's almost like they've got the major and the minor going on at the same time.
So it's like you come out and you feel uplifted even though your heart's broken.
Yeah.
And in this, I mean, obviously you've got the alchemy, the two fantastic female singers, mezzo-soprano and a soprano together, Agnetha and Anifrid, just their voices just blending perfectly. But here, Agnetha is her, she's so great at singing about heartache.
Yeah.
You know, she sounds like she's on the verge of bursting into tears all the time in this song. I mean, and it's absolutely complemented here by you got these descending chords, and at the same time there's this mini Moog sort of synthesizer kind of going underneath in a slightly sinister way, and it's like, and there's still the, I mean, it's about, you know, she's still in love with someone who's left her. Or is it? Or is it about the fact that, you know, is the relationship over? Or is it that they're just separated and she can't be with the one she loves? So she's sending out an SOS for him to come back and for everything to be okay. The best ABBA songs almost feel like a little mini film in themselves.
Mini Bergman film, definitely.
Yeah,
definitely.
But it's, I mean, it's. But sometimes it's difficult to disassociate ABBA with the visuals of the sort of Lasse Hallström directed music videos, which I love, but you know, have a certain kitsch charm to them. I'll say that. But if you just take it as song, as a pop single, it is a perfect thing. Love ABBA and SOS for me, it typifies all the things that they're great at as a group, and I think it's about remains uplifting. After that, you start getting into the sort of Knowing Me, Knowing You.
Oh.
And then, I mean, to be honest, my favourite one to sing at karaoke
is The Winner Takes It All.
Winner Takes It All.
Yeah, it's of course great. It is.
And again, that's another Agnetha sort of talking about how her heart's broken.
Yeah.
She's so magnanimous about it? It just breaks your heart, you know? Oh.
Oh, it's, yeah.
At certain points, you know, I mean, I've been listening to, we'll come on to this later, but I've been listening to a lot of quite, you know, what could describe as soppy love songs recently. A lot of ballads, a lot of soft rock, a lot of heartfelt stuff about love. And so, and combined with that, and there are some beautiful songs about love, which are almost like hymnal, you know. But that's not necessarily what I think about when I think about a great single, you know. You know, like, you know, I'm thinking of things like Imagine, which I think it's one of my mum's favourite singles, or like Bridge Over Troubled Waters. I love those songs. Or Nothing Compares to You, Shane O'Connor version of the Prince song. They're beautiful songs, but they don't necessarily... I think of them as great songs, not necessarily as great singles, even though, you know, they were like all monster hits. So it's interesting. I personally didn't go that way with my choices.
It would be very easy to go that way, but in some ways it's the more subtle choice to go with ABBA, because you kind of think of it as just a pop song.
Yeah.
And the best pop songs are never just pop songs. There's always more.
Absolutely, but if I'm looking at through line of my picks so far, they've all got this kind of absolutely impassioned vocal.
Yeah, 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 definitely.
You know, whether they're talking about love or heartbreak or whatever. So, there we go. On to your number three.
On to my number three. Now, number three was the one that caused slight contention between myself and my podcasting partner here, in that they both... It made both it made my short list almost immediately, but it made both our long lists.
You might say he bagsied it.
I'll put my hand up. I did actually bagsy that one.
It's fine. I will tell you my baby story after you.
Spoiler alert, everyone. The reason that I picked "Be My Baby" by the Ronettes is kind of, there are so many spoilers going on here. I'm being completely ruined. When I was doing this, I obviously have certain bands that I go back to, my favourite bands, time and time again. R.E.M.
The Wurzels.
Tom Waits. Bruce Springsteen, specifically, I have a very, very strong place in my heart for.
Big Country, you've spoken about.
Yes, we've mentioned Big Country more than once. Yeah, in a Big Country, very nearly made the cut. But with Springsteen particularly, I really wanted to put the Springsteen song in, but I kept going back to the fact that Springsteen is all about the Ronettes, and he's all about that kind of deal, that whole sort of big punch. And in the end, I just sort of thought, well, let's just go back to the prime source. Let's go back to the heart of it. And the Ronettes' Be My Baby is, to my mind, without a doubt, the great single of all time. It just, there's no argument for me. It is what it is, just a perfect piece of work. It nails everything, again, on our framework.
Yeah.
The simplicity of it is beautiful. You get that sort of two bars of that, two bars of the intro, and then bang, and you're in. And it's like, the night we met, I knew I needed you so, and if I had the chance, I'd never let you go. It just doesn't get any better than that. That's everything that you want in a pop song in, 10, 12 seconds in at that point, and that's it, and you're away, and you're rolling. It's what, 2.5 minutes long, that song, and it just encapsulates so much about the human condition and so much about what we are.
It's that thing of we're talking about great pop songs here, as you know, that's what a great single is.
Mm.
But it's that thing of sometimes a song can be more eloquent than, you know, than a novel, than even than a short story. It's that marriage.
Mm.
Of everything together, and yeah,
I think we were talking about mixtapes earlier on, and mixtapes become very important when you're talking about this, because it probably doesn't happen so much anymore, but certainly when I was at the point where I was at mixtape making age, you put your heart and soul into creating this perfect thing, this perfect distillation of the music that you loved and the music that you thought kind of encapsulated what you were, or the stuff that you thought was cool and you wanted to pass on. It was a really big deal to make a mixtape and pass it on to someone that you cared about. I mean, Spotify playlists can sort of do that, but the whole thing about sitting in front of a tape deck, doing the whole sort of play record, pause, taking it off, recording the song.
Yeah, I know, and there was always that thing of you're up against a time limit, so you might have something written down, have it all worked out, but then for some reason the tape is that bit shorter, and it's an absolute no-no to have a song cut off before the end, isn't it?
Yeah. So you've got to lose that song.
Songs that are under 3 minutes are good, aren't they?
Absolutely.
And if they're great songs by themselves, then that's fantastic.
That's a winner. Be My Baby, of course, is the perfect start to any mixtape.
Yeah.
Whatever mixtape you're making. I think there should be... I'd love to see a revival of that. I know,
if your mixtape is best country and western, perhaps that would be an orthodox choice. But
No, I think it still works.
Yeah, it's just fantastic.
Yeah, it is an absolute joy. And if you're ever feeling down or low, I think that's the track just to put on. 2.5 minutes of just yearning and sheer joy. It's a wonderful, wonderful track. And the fact that me and Clive both fought about putting it on, and I won. Clive, you said you had a Be My Baby story.
Yeah, you could say that Be My Baby is the reason why I became a filmmaker.
Ah, this would be the Scorsese thing, would it?
No, it's because of my love of Dirty Dancing. No, this is specifically for those of you who have seen the film Mean Streets. There is a And maybe this is more the reason I ended up going into editing as much as anything. For me, what made me think, yes, this is what I want to do, was a combination, like a 1-2 punch of two different films. But there's one specific moment in one of those films, which is Martin Scorsese's Mean Streets, where the moment I saw it, I was like, yes, 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 this is absolutely what I want to do. I love how that has just worked. And it's like the perfect crystallization of music and image together, and the juxtaposing the two things, you know, in a montage to create. I'll set the scene up. It doesn't spoil any of the main plot of the film. You have the character played by Harvey Keitel in the movie called Charlie, and after a little bit of a kind of monologue in voiceover, he talks about how you pay for your sins on the street, and then
it's a very Springsteen line that as well.
Yeah, and that sort of sets up the whole his whole ethos and the whole idea behind the film. But this whole thing is the voiceover here is just played out without any music at all. And then, so he's sitting on the edge of his bed, and then he just lays down back on his bed. And then as he lays his head back down onto the pillow, it jump cuts to those opening beats from Be My Baby. And Be My Baby kicks in, and we get the opening credits to Mean Streets. And at that moment, I was gone. I was like, yes.
It's one of the greatest cuts.
It's a perfect moment of editing. It's absolutely right. And, you know, apart from... It shows what you can do with film. It's one of those moments. You know.
Well, what you can do with film and music, I think.
Yes, film, because everyone gets fixated on the visuals, you know, rightly so, it's important, but the audio side of things can get neglected. But if you think of your favourite moments from film, so many of them are you will associate with a particular musical score. I mean, one of our guests on the podcast has been Neil Myers, you know, mm-hmm. We talked about that. But this is one of those moments where the two come together and I think sort of give something to each other, you know. Sometimes it feels like films just vampirize off good songs, you know, like just to sort of have them there and sort of boost their soundtrack, you know. Mm-hmm. But this, it's a marriage, it's great. I mean, there are other great song moments in Mean Streets, like Johnny Boy's entrance to Jumpin' Jack Flash is fantastic, or the Rubber Biscuit song, where Harvey Keitel's character is sort of roaming around drunk in the bar, and the camera's attached to him, and it's this fantastic, again, bravura sort of Scorsese moment. But sometimes people have a go at Scorsese for being a show-off. You know, like they do some other things, you know, because he's always throwing the camera around and doing these things. But it's always with a purpose. It's not random, you know. He's trying to get an emotional response, and it absolutely does that. Anyway, we're drifting,
but
a very big sidetrack there. But yeah. Yes, that's my Proustian medley for that one.
There we go. I can almost taste that.
And now on to another Proustian Madeleine.
Marvellous. Pick number four.
Okay, so this one is very much for me tied in with a particular memory, and it's with my, you know, with memories of the childhood. Sometimes it's a bit of a haze. If someone sort of mentions the thing that happens to you, then it will come back to you. But those moments where you can actually sort of immediately hear a piece of music and go back there, are rare.
Mm.
Okay, I'm going to set the scene here. Okay, the year is 1982, and I am sitting in the back of my dad's Vauxhall Chevette,
This is really Proustian, I'm loving it.
Yeah, in the back of my dad's Vauxhall Chiffet, I'm in the middle of the back seat. Next to me are my, this time I'm 8 years old. I'm sitting next to me are my brother Richard, 6 years old, and my sister Claire Louise, 4 years old. In the front two seats, my dad is driving and my mum is in the passenger seat. The radio is on in the car, and
of course
we are driving down Angestine Road in Portsmouth in North End up towards the Mountbatten Sports Centre, which will mean something to anyone who's ever been to, who's lived in Portsmouth, but probably not to anyone else, but
it's
specific anyway. So it is a beautiful sunny summer holiday weekend day,
right?
It's Sunday afternoon in August of 1982. And I can pin it down to that much because of the chart positions to what we're listening to. We are listening, in fact, to the Radio 1 chart show, which I believe is being presented by Tommy Vance at that time. Okay. And at this moment, we are just finishing is Survivor by Eye of the Tiger, which is the number.
Eye of the Tiger by Survivor.
Yes, the other way around, even. Yeah, so Eye of the Tiger by Survivor is number two in the chart.
Okay.
And becomes.
What is number one?
What is number one? Can you?
Come on, Eileen.
It is Come On, Eileen. So, yeah, my number four pick is Come On, Eileen by Dexys Midnight Runners. B-side was dubious. So we have a bit of Celtic folk pop meets blue-eyed soul. And it's just a great single. But I put this for a particular reason. So, this is quite a rare moment for us in the car in that we're actually listening to the radio and listening to pop music, because my dad, as the driver, had absolute veto on whatever music was played in the car, which normally meant his music.
That is the law.
That is the law. Yeah. He's the driver. He doesn't want to be distracted with like other things, you know. Okay. So he gets the pick. You know,
so what would be his choice?
His choice would generally be, at this moment in time, would either be Bob Dylan.
Okay.
Or it would be Vangelis.
Okay.
Or it would be classical music.
Right.
Okay. And there would be nothing after 1974, where I was born.
Right.
So... obviously he was in a good mood because we convinced him to put on the radio and have some pop music playing. And not only that, you know, so we were, this is the thing. We were singing along to Eye of the Tiger and then it comes on with number one, Come On, Eileen. And then we're singing along to Come On, Eileen. And everyone in the car is singing along to Come On, Eileen, including my dad, who is not the sort of
person that sings along
to sings along stuff, but it's so infectious. It's such an infectious song. He's singing along as well. Everyone's singing along. And the reason this stuck in my mind, because it's not, you know, I can't even tell you where we were going in the car. I have no memory of that at all. I remember that, because I remember I was singing and I'm looking around in the car. And I remember at that moment, I had an absolute sort of moment of like, of happiness.
Mm.
Of like, it's so rare. I mean, you know, hopefully, you're listening to this, you've been happy, you've had moments of happiness in your life, I pray. But sometimes you only realize those after the fact, like when things go badly, and you're like, you know what, that you know, those past few months were great, and I was in the rush of it, I didn't really realize, but just occasionally you catch yourself and you go, at this moment, right now, I am happy.
Mm.
And this is one of those. Maybe the only time in my life where I. I'm not saying the only time I've been happy.
No, but where are you going with that?
No, where I can actually sort of say at this, you know, at that moment. Let's put it slightly differently. It was the first time that I had that sort of moment of realization, you know. I'm happy right now, and I'm looking around and looking at all. I'm with my family and with, you know, the people I love. We're singing, we're having this bonding experience. It's great. We're enjoying this music, and ever since then, I've had like this Pavlovian response to Come Alive. And for those who don't know what that slightly pretentious term means, it's a reference to Pavlov's dog, which is this famous psychological experiment done where the scientist rang a bell every time he gave his dog food. And after a while, the dog became conditioned so that all he had to do was ring the bell and it would, and its mouth would water with saliva. It would salivate.
Mm.
So it's about a conditioned response. So as soon as I hear this song, I'm happy. It's like a, you know, it's like an unconscious thing. It makes me happy. So that's always good to know if you're in a bad time, you know, to have a song like that. So, I mean, I you know, I could point out how this is a very clever, you know, cleverly constructed song with great, you know, with a great horn section going in it. You know, the fact that it's got this brilliant bridge where everything accelerates until you think the horn section is about to explode.
It's an amazing dance floor song.
It's a brilliant song to dance to, and yeah, that bridge bit where everyone just
hammers away,
it's absolutely fantastic. And so, you know, building on top of this opening memory I have are memories of dancing to this at discos, at weddings or whatever. And it's always a great song to dance to. It always makes you feel good.
It's always a floor filler. Everyone just piles onto it. Doesn't matter what else is going on. You know, towards the end of the night, it's going to be Come On Eileen, My Way.
Yeah.
That's it pretty much, really.
And it's okay. And Dexys, as they now call themselves, are one of these bands, and particularly at this period in time, Come On Eileen, they had this very particular image, which is this dungarees and neckerchief and sort of beret image.
Sort of weird kind of dust bowl, kind of hobo-ish.
Yeah, I mean, it's the sort of image where you have to have real kind of chutzpah and confidence to pull off. And Kevin Rowland does, I think. But when you look back at it, it looks silly and 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah. I you know, people aren't rocking that look now because it's you know, you need to have a certain swagger to pull that off. But even swagger makes it difficult. I'm not sure anyone could pull off dungarees. They're
certainly not in the weather we're having at the moment.
No. So I think that it's almost become a slight, you know, that sort of image of Dexys makes them seem slightly comedy.
Yeah, whereas Dexys has always been a band that sort of moved through particular stages. You know,
yeah.
They had their...
That was just a moment, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
They've always been very kind of image specific in terms of, you know, that they weren't a band that was just going to rock up in the same clothes they were on the street. They would dress up. They would be very precise, you know. I think there was a nice bit. I mean, they've been touring recently, and if you haven't heard their latest album, it's actually very good. But they had this. It's like on the tickets for their, I think it was their latest sort of tour. It said, you know, sort of dress up, we will, you know, on their kind of thing like that. You know, sort of like make an effort because we're going to do it.
Yeah. You know, that's always been the thing about Dexys. They've always made the effort. Whatever you think of the music, I mean, the music's great. They've always, again, been a fantastic...
Yeah, and they're such a tight band. But it's it's that thing of... I think an example of this is like, you know, the comedy series Spaced.
Yeah.
Do you remember can you picture the scene I'm talking about, which is the character of Brian has like a phobia about going to clubs because of he had a bad Come On Eileen experience. Do you remember? He went to a club, Come On Eileen is playing, and he's in the full dungarees and, you know, beret and the whole bit.
Yeah.
And he accidentally spills someone's pint and then he gets punched. And then he never goes to a club again until he gets convinced to go to this rave. Rave type club or house club, and gets E'd up, and then everyone opens up, and it's very amusing in the thing, but it sort of speaks this idea of that image being an inherently comedic one, and I'm saying divorce that from the song. Obviously, I have this particular fondness for this song.
Mm.
Not everyone, you know, I don't expect people listening to this going to immediately put Come On Eileen and feel like an immense, like Proustian rush of happiness, because they won't have that same association. But it's a great single. So I think it absolutely belongs on my list.
There you go. I absolutely agree with that as well. My pick number four, I'm going to kind of contextualise this a little bit and talk about electronic music as a whole, as in terms of...
I'm glad you've got some electronic music, because I love electronic music, and it pains me that I don't really have a proper, you know, hardcore electronic, early electronic song on here, because I love that, but... I couldn't fit it into my top five.
I think for me, it was just because I was kind of, when I was listening to music and consuming music and buying music so much, that was kind of when you were getting this huge uprush. Obviously, you know, you've got Kraftwerk, we're going from like 1975, sort of, concurrently. You've kind of got these two streams going on. You've got punk carrying on, and sort of under that, you're getting the sort of electronic stuff, and they're both all about do it yourself. They're about sort of taking a position and sticking to it, and they're about kind of trying something new.
But in a way, that early electronic stuff is more truly punk than punk.
Absolutely, because it's all about kind of just
it's about creating a completely new sound.
Yeah, which it does.
It's not about, you know, much as I love the Sex Pistols and the Damned and all the great punk bands, a lot of that is just, it's going back to the 50s again.
Well, it's string chord rock and roll. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, I mean, it's ripping it up and starting again. But it's starting again with kind of a new variation on what we've already had.
Well, you sort of go back to the whole... the cover of Sniffing Glue number one, the punk fanzine that basically had a picture of three chords on it and underneath Now Form a Band. Of course, the three chords that were picked are the standard three rock and roll chords, you know, it was A, C and E. It's just like bang, 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 now off you go. Whereas you get yourself a synthesizer and all of a sudden you've got a whole different palette opened up to you.
I love the idea that you're sitting down to write something, and just by the process of, you know, plugging into slot B and twisting that knob and turning that dial, you are making a sound and recording a sound no one has created before.
Mm. And certainly with the early synthesizer, it was a sound that you frequently couldn't recreate either.
Absolutely, which is a pain in the ass, obviously.
But the other thing that sort of made it so good for kind of giving people that didn't really have musical talent but had the urge to go out and make music and write songs was things like the arpeggiator that was built into a lot of early synthesizers that basically would allow you to hit a note, and then the synthesizer would basically run up and down the scale. So very, very quickly, you could build up with maybe two or three notes a very, very complicated sounding riff, which was still very, very simple, but the machine was doing 90% of the work for you.
Yeah.
So, for example, Pete Townshend claims that the synth riff that starts off Won't Get Fooled Again was completely played by him, but I'm frankly calling bullshit on that, because it sounds so much like a very basic arpeggiated three chord sequence to me, with a few little trills added in after the event. But be that as it may, the synthesizer did kind of bring people who weren't coming up traditionally and weren't interested in doing the three chord bang bang bang, and gave them the chance to make extraordinarily good pop songs. I mean, people like Vince Clarke of Depeche Mode, later Erasure.
Yazoo.
The Pet Shop Boys, for example. Dave Ball and Mark Almond of...
And I'm surprised you haven't picked one of those people. You've gone for...
I've gone really hardcore with my electronic music pick.
Okay, I'm going to paint a picture for you here, listeners. Rob has ripped open the front of his shirt. There is a cape fluttering from his shoulders. He's striking a fists on hips pose.
Just looks at me and shakes his head and just goes, "Oh."
I do. So this is the Tubeboy Army song, right?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. This is our friend's electric. No, my pick is about as anti a single as any single can be. It's Laurie Anderson's "Oh Superman," it's not a song. It is not a song. It's 9 minutes long. It has really very little in the way of a discernible tune. And its vocal delivery is a very cool, calm monologue on the way communication is gradually easing us apart as a society. So we're becoming more.
If I hadn't heard it and already loved it, Rob, I'd say you're really selling me.
It's a joy. If you can imagine J.G. Ballard as a single.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, one of the, as part of my research is I did sort of re-look at the book of sort of best singles since punk and disco, and this was in there. I posted the thing up on social media as part of our sort of conversation with you folks out there, and I can't disagree with that pick as a great single because it is utterly unique.
There's nothing else like it out there.
I mean, I guess you could almost peg it as a novelty single because it's a novelty in that nothing else is like it.
Hmm.
It's kind of an earworm.
Very much.
It doesn't have, like you say, a tune, but it has that sort of...
That single note synth thing that goes all the way through. It's a riff. Regardless of the fact that it's not traditionally what you call a riff, it anchors the tune, it starts the tune off, and you know what you're listening to from the first 5 seconds of listening to it.
Yeah.
You know exactly where you're going from. So it's... I remember first hearing it on the radio a few weeks before it came out and just being absolutely hooked by it for reasons that I still kind of find hard to actually put into words. It's a very science fiction-y sounding thing for a start. It turned about at a time when I was very, very much into electronic music. The whole sort of ultra rock thing was very big with me then. All those sort of things. It sounds a little bit as well like The Normals' "Warm Leatherette," which is another single.
I love "Warm Leatherette."
It again has a really simple nagging synth pulse going through it.
"Warm Leatherette's" probably got more of a hook, I would say, and it's shorter.
It's shorter, but again, it's that pulse with the very cool spoken vocal.
It's very James Ballard as well.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, yeah, it's basically. It's Crash, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that one is, but I mean, so is "Oh Superman" to a degree.
Yeah, absolutely. It is science fictional, which is kind of why I dig it so much. I remember actually going to buy this single at the time if I needed to buy music, my local record shop was probably a mile and a half's walk away from my house, and I did that walk to and from, in the rain, had tucked this single, which was just plain paper.
Listeners, when you're listening, you got to sort of soundtrack to this, that sort of Hovis sort of music. He's going up and down sort of like a cobbled street. He's got a brown loaf under his arm, and he's got a little push bike.
This is suburban Essex, folks. I don't think that image quite works.
Well, I mean, and that's why he got bullied a lot as well. Because his parents made him dress like
it was the flat cap that did it.
Anyway,
but the fact I was so excited by going out and physically owning this record,
yes,
coming back with it tucked away safely, it's like I own this now. It's great. played it like three or four times at home until I got shouted out to turn that rubbish off. Which again is another good thing.
That's another
key point about the single. It should piss your parents off.
Yes.
And this one really did.
Especially if you're playing over and over again and they hate that.
At high volume, which I did.
I think at this point, before, because we are at our last picks, aren't we? I think we're going to break because, hey, it's not long enough, this podcast, is it? We'll add a bit more. We're going to talk now about the first singles we ever bought, because I think that segues on nicely from what you're talking about, that experience of going to the record shop and picking up the single and having it in your hand. So, Rob, what was the first single or singles you ever bought?
The first single I ever bought, wow.
Sip of wine.
Sip of wine, I think. I can certainly talk about the first albums I ever bought. In fact, I played the first album that I ever bought last week. Which is
Deviation.
Morning to Crescent, right, okay. The first, unnervingly, I think, the first single I ever bought was actually Laurie Anderson's Oh Superman.
Wow,
because I was an album buyer before that point.
That's interesting. And you never had a single bought for you?
Now, yes, I did have a single bought for me.
And what was that?
That single was bought for me by my loving grandma, and it was Long Haired Lover from Liverpool by Little Johnny Osmond.
Fantastic.
And that's what you wanted to hear, wasn't it?
Well, that's slightly embarrassing, the first single thing. Not everyone's first single is embarrassing. Some people's first singles are achingly hip.
Yeah.
I don't know that mine are, but, you know, there we go. Okay, so I started this, so I should
press you up. Should, yeah.
Okay. First single I bought, I actually bought two together.
Okay.
And it was sort of like, we went into Woolworths on.
See, now that's a very English thing to do as well. Buying your first single in Woolworths.
Yes,
when of a certain age.
Yes, went into Woolworths on the in North End High Street in Portsmouth, and there was the bit of Woolworths which is our price, where they had all the chart singles and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I went up there and I got from my mum. Birthday money that was due I can't remember whether it was actually from my gran or whether it was just part of my birthday present or whatever. But I got my in my hot little hand. I had my birthday money and I bought my favourite singles that were out at that moment. And the first things I ever bought, my favourite songs, and I think, in my mind, they were number one and number two in the charts at that time, but they may not have been.
Right.
One was definitely number one, but and they were A View to a Kill by Duran Duran.
Nice.
And 19 by Paul Hardcastle.
Wow. Well, that's two sides of the same coin, isn't it?
Yeah, what can I say? I like electronic music. But I think, 19 is a really interesting song in that it's kind of like a proto song for so many other things that follow after it.
Yeah, it's very much a kind of collage. Really,
yeah, it's sort of, without 19, you don't get things like Frontier Psychiatrist by the Avalanches, or any of the.
Well, Pump Up the Volume by Mars, stuff like that.
Yeah, all of that sort of sampling, sequencing stuff that feeds into dance music and hip hop. Mm.
Well, the sort of mashups that we get these days, the sort of stuff that Booty do so well.
I mean, public service broadcasting is basically, Paul Hardcastle's 19, And it's sort of weird, because if you listen to any other Paul Hardcastle stuff, it's pretty much, it's sort of jazz.
Really?
So it's all verging on that electronic towards jazz, and he's got loads of these sort of albums and stuff, and this was his only sort of breakthrough single, I think, I'm right in saying. It's certainly the one the only one that broke through to my consciousness as a young teenager in the 80s. And it's got the great hook, to it, the sort of, that sort of vocal repeated
19.
Yeah, you got the 19 and all that, you know, none of them are superheroes, welcome, you know. And it's sort of, at the same time, that the sort of nice synthesizer sort of line through it, the sort of almost like Axel F.
It is actually, yeah, it's got that kind of Harold Faltermeyer kind of feel to it. It's quite light and chimey, isn't it?
It's quite light and chimey, but at the top, you've got this heavy kind of sort of.
Again, the sort of sampled string.
Yeah, but that, and the repetition really gets you. And repetition in songs sometimes really, really
well, in
works.
Singles especially. Definitely.
Yeah. So, yeah, love that. And if I'm honest, the thing that got me about the Duran Duran single was the video. Was, you know, it's James Bond, you know, and I think I've probably seen the film at that point. Definitely seen the video before I bought this, and yeah, the video at the time seems the amazing thing where suddenly Duran Duran were in the film, and you watch it now, it's got these really, really 80s video effects in it, but it's at the same time, it's quite entertaining.
I actually prefer the video to View from a Kill to the actual film. It's more entertaining in a short space of time.
If I could do a Christopher Walken impression, then I would have launched into one there, admonishing you. But I can sort of see what you mean. It's good fun, and it's sort of got the best sequence from the film.
Absolutely. Am I right in thinking that was co-written with John Barry as well? Because it's got that whole sort of the Barry-esque kind of string tumble.
I don't know. I definitely wasn't. It wasn't something I was aware of when I bought it, you know.
You were all about the Duranis at the time.
I was all about the James Bond and the hooky single. And the electronic.
Yeah, yeah. It's a right clip. You don't have to admit in public. It's fine.
Whatever.
Yeah, look, I'm married to a Durani, and I've seen them live.
Okay.
They did actually kick
for that
live as well.
You get to tell us your last choice.
Okay, first. My final choice. Once upon a time, listenership, I was a goth. I was an 80s goth. I was really, well, I mean, I'm skinny now, but I was really, really skinny back then. And when I was a student...
You see, you didn't think Fields of the Nephilim were going to get on here, did you?
Wait and see. It's better than that. There was a club in Bournemouth where myself and my girlfriend at the time, now my lovely wife, used to frequent, called The Third Side, which I think is now, I'm not sure if it's still extant in Bournemouth, but at the time that we were there, it was the goth place to go. So every sort of Friday, Saturday night, we would go to The Third Side and we would drink our cider and blacks and wear our eyeliner. And we used to have hair halfway down my back that would get crimped. Layered with
this is where I'm envious. I didn't really have a tribe. I felt in between musical.
Nah, that was the one time where I actually felt like I fitted in to the Third Side, and it was as skanky and horrible a club as you'd expect something like that to be. So there were many standout songs from that era that we really went for. Obviously, we've talked about The Cure earlier on, so The Cure were very big. Fields of Nephilim.
This is that kind of early Cure before the kind of Friday I'm in Love.
No, Friday I'm in Love was in there as well.
Okay.
Yeah, we're talking sort of 80s.
So I was thinking more like A Forest or something like
that. No, they used to play stuff like A Forest as well, but we're talking sort of 87, 88 here.
Okay.
But the one song for me that would always be the song to go to was my final pick, which is The Cult's She Sells Sanctuary.
Oh.
And I can still say that even with this much wine.
She sells
by the seashore.
It's got a great riff.
It's a fantastic dance floor song.
I definitely had this on a mixtape. Love this.
What I love so much about this song is the fact that it's got that chiming sort of jangly guitar intro, just a little bit gentle over about 8 bars, just about gives you enough time to prick up your ears and go, I know what's coming, get on the dance floor, strike a pose, and then just wait for that drum hit. As soon as you get that drum hit and the main riff kicks in, then you're away.
Yeah.
And it's Hairspray at Dawn, and it's just like arms everywhere, moshy moshy, crazy crazy, and it's just an blissful time. It's such a great single. Again, it's about this whole head rush. It's about being part of a community that maybe isn't really what everyone else is interested in. You know, the whole thing about, you know, the world drags you down.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. But it's also about being in love as well. You know, I'm sure in her, I'll find the sanctuary. It's that kind of thing. So it's everything at once, and everything that I was feeling and everything that I was young, in love, and dressed in black. And that was me. So that's why I picked that as my final pick, because it kind of sums me up at this particular time in my life. And that's it. That's my five.
Wow, that's your five. And you know, I can't sort of point at any of those five. I wouldn't anyway, but because this is very sort of specific to each of us, you know. But I love all those five. I think they're great. So, you know, well done, you.
Thank you very much.
My fifth pick, I struggled with this for a long time. I had a long list, I think, which was mentioned.
You always have a long list.
I always have a long list. And I chopped and changed here. And I kept coming back to a couple of songs. And because I was worried, or I thought that, because one of the things I love about singles is that sort of, that thing of a great sort of rock single or a great metal single, whatever, where it's got the great riff and it really thunders and you can dance to it or mosh to it or whatever.
Yeah.
And I had several kind of songs like that, which sort of flirted with the edge of my list, you know, where I had distinct memories of dancing to those at indie discos, or at like rock clubs like Chaos, which used to be in, on the pier in Portsmouth.
Chaos on the pier. That's how
dodgy
50s British beat movie, doesn't it?
There are dodgy stories associated with Chaos on the pier, but we won't go into those.
Again, readership, writing, we'll stick it in as bonus material.
Will we? Just getting more drunk than this.
We'll make something up. It'll be
fine. So, and I didn't want all my choices to just be sort of a certain kind of song, if you know what I mean. I wanted a bit of variety in there. I wanted to sort of show. So there were a few songs what I thought about. I almost went with like Nirvana Smells Like Teen Spirit was very, very close, because I've absolutely jumped around like a loon to that. So
it's such a game changer of a single as well.
It is, and it's got talk about the perfect opening. I'm talking about now about singles that haven't made my list. That's a massive cheat, sort of
he's
one
trying
of
to sneak
mentions.
In his long list now.
But, and I thought about that, and you know, singles by Beastie Boys, AC/DC, sort of, you know, and a lot of heavier stuff, which I was absolutely really into when I was younger. But the thing is, this is a list for me now, and if I was asked to make this list again, you know, a few months' time, it might well change.
I think it should change, and I think that's
you know,
important.
And I know absolutely that I would not have made this list this way just a few months ago. But, so now I come to my actual pick, there's a lot of talk sometimes about guilty pleasures, about certain things where people should feel guilty about, because it's like a genre which is, you know, frowned upon by the critics.
Which is huge music snobbery, and I've never...
It is, and I don't follow that at all.
No.
Which is why I think, but I know that this pick, there would be certain, like the music journalist who listens to this go, oh well, I'm disappointed in Clive there, because you know I was really with him up to this point. I'm going to, before I say what it is, I'm going to read the lyrics to the first couple of verses and the chorus, because I think it's going to sort of, you know, there's a reason for this.
Mm.
One, I think they are kind of, they're great sort of pop poetry in what they do, and also it's an example of what I want to talk about, if you see what I mean. So see if you can see how soon you can get what this song is. Do you know what it is? I can't remember if I told you.
No, I've got no clue.
Okay. I hear the drums echoing tonight, but she hears only whispers of some quiet conversation. She's coming in 12:30 flight. Her moonlit wings reflect the stars that guide me towards salvation. I stopped an old man along the way, hoping to find some old forgotten words or ancient melodies. He turned to me as if to say, "Hurry, boy, it's waiting there for you. It's going to take a lot to drag me away from you. There's nothing that 100 men or more could ever do. I bless the rains down in Africa. Going to take some time to do the things we never had. Ooh, ooh. The wild dogs cry out in the night as they grow restless, longing for some solitary company. I know that I must do what's right. Sure as Kilimanjaro rises like Olympus above the Serengeti. I seek to cure what's deep inside, frightened of this thing that I've become."
I mean, that's remarkable imagery all the way through, isn't it?
It is. It's... I want to talk now, folks. I'm going to talk about my personal connection to this song, which, if you've not got it already, is Africa by Toto. But I want to talk about the kind of alchemical power of pop music, which is that words and, like, almost sometimes on the nose imagery, sometimes sort of things that if you wrote down in a script or a story would seem cheesy and trite and just obvious. When you combine them with melody, somehow they work. And this, for me, absolutely works. Toto are one of those bands where they're sort of like soft rock, MOR, AOR, kind of, they're around that time. I mean, you know, I could have picked like tracks from people like Fleetwood Mac, or I could have gone with Mr. Mister or something like that.
I mean, Toto for me always felt a little bit anonymous, but they kind of built up from musicians that really, really know their stuff and know their craft.
Yeah, I mean, they're always really well constructed songs. I'm not making a case for every single one of Toto's songs being great. I'm making a case for this song meaning something to me, and I think that it, as a single, it's like a perfect encapsulation of what they do well when they're at their best. I also like that it's kind of a meta song.
Yeah.
It's a song written about a white boy who's never been to Africa trying to write a song about Africa based purely on documentaries he's seen and half-remembered facts.
Mm.
And there's something kind of naive and honest about that in a way. So you can listen to Africa and it's okay, and there are times that it approaches silliness in there, and I won't deny that. But it's never patronising the way that, say, Band-Aid is.
Yeah.
If you see what I mean. And that is an utterly sincere song, and I don't believe that they were trying to be like that, but they hit those kind of false notes anyway in the lyrics, I think, to Do They Know It's Christmas. But Africa does, like, it gets away with it because it's kind of, I'm not quite sure why, because it's sort of Maybe because it's kind of silly, but there are poetic images in
the lyrics.
Yeah, I don't
think it's patronising towards the country in the way that, say, Band Aid always was. It's more about trying to capture an image. But like you say, it being a whole sort of meta thing about sort of capturing an image in a way that's kind of filtered through the way that the character's actually.
I'd also make a sort of case for it being kind of cleverer than it seems on the surface. In that there are some of those sort of lines which are kind of long run on lines where you have to sing them kind of as one line in one breath.
Yeah.
And therefore it kind of gives it added feeling. It's like built into the song. So that line, "Sure as Kilimanjaro rises like Olympus above the Serengeti," you know, it's like one syllable too much in that line.
Yeah.
And because you have to force it in, it sort of gives it
that final punch.
Yeah, it gives it a punch. It's this one I love singing at SingStar.
I'm seeing a whole new side of
it.
I had no idea.
Love singing this one.
That you were a karaoke fiend.
It's beautifully ludicrous to sing. I love it. But it's got a great video, cheesy video directed by Steve Barron.
The king of cheesy videos.
Which is beautifully 80s. It's sort of an unusual song for Toto in that David Page takes the lead vocals on it, which isn't always the way on their songs, you know, kind of like Hold the Line and sort of Rosanna. I don't believe he's the lead singer on those ones, you know. I mean, he's singing on it, but he's not the lead. So there's all that, and the fact that you could say this is, you know, it's definitely a very kind of sampled song, you know.
Mm.
It's been sampled death by, you know, hip hop artists like Nas, Exhibit, Ja Rule. You know,
a lot of those hip hop guys really love their soft rock as well, don't they? You talk to them about Phil Collins, for example,
and
they're all over that.
For you synthesizer geeks, this track features a Yamaha GH1. And Yamaha CS80 synthesizer,
nice.
But you know, combined with the marimba. Who doesn't like a marimba?
There's some very nice marimba on.
Oh, there's some great. And I have to say, this is, if you like doing a bit of air synthesizer playing, the sort of instrumental break is fantastic for that. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
I know it. It's there. It's trembling on the edge of my fingertips.
But for me, the reason this makes my top five over, because the rock people are sitting it like, "You chose this over Smells Like Teen Spirit. What is wrong with you, man?" Is that this is the first song I bonded with my lovely girlfriend Radi over. The fact that we both love this song, and we, you know, and that's as simple as that. So where I am right now, that's more important than all that other stuff.
Yeah. I mean, that was the punchline I was kind of waiting for. Obviously, I know about your change in personal circumstance.
So yes, I love this song and it means something to me, and that's why I picked it. Yeah. So there.
So again, our framework holds throughout our two top fives.
Yeah.
And that's that.
So, you know, we come to, you know, it looks like we might have made it, Rob. It looks like we've made it to the end.
Slightly strange to come to the end of this journey, but this is the closing of one chapter and the beginning of another chapter for myself and my partner sitting directly there somewhere. Starting in March, we are beginning a whole new journey, a very, very long journey. We'll be commencing the A to Z of SFF, which is, as it sounds, basically a podcast that deals with science fiction and fantasy in strict alphabetical order.
Well,
kind.
it's strict in that we will be going A's and then B's and then C's, but we won't be going like
Aaron, AA.
You know, we won't be going Aaron A Aardvark and then, you know, and so on. You know, it won't be AAA, AB, AC. It will be, we'll jump around within the A's, but then we will cover
many A's.
Many A's.
There are
I believe we have 2 years worth of
entries. We have slightly over, actually. We've got 107 A's at the moment, which, that's the other thing that I do need to point out. One of the reasons.
It's going to be a weekly podcast.
Thank you. That was what I was.
Yeah,
working my way around.
My God, how many years they plan to do this for?
as opposed to the monthly output that we have been doing with the speakeasy, we're going to go to a shorter but more conventionally weekly output.
Yeah.
So
you, in terms of what we've been talking about today, you might like to think of this as a sort of change from prog to punk.
Absolutely.
Because we have, the speakeasy has been very much like long prog albums, hasn't it? You know,
it has
of,
been pretty epic at times.
You know, each one has had each podcast has its own separate concept, not necessarily relating at all to the one before. Sometimes they've been as long as 3.5 hours. God bless you if you listen to all of those.
3 hours, 44 minutes actually was our longest ever podcast, which was the one immediately before this one. So talk about going out with a blast.
Yeah. So we're blowing away those that sort of that format and going back to a more punk like not 3 minutes, but
we're looking at basically a 15-minute podcast once a week at a predictable time. So not quite sure what that time is going to be yet. That's still in discussion. But starting in very, very early March, expect to be listening to the A to Z of SFF, which you'll be able to listen to at the A to Z of SFF.com. Let's nail it down. We've always been very, very passionate about a lot of stuff, but science fiction and fantasy has always been our go-to. It's always been the thing we've loved the most. And one of the reasons that we wanted to sort of break away from the speakeasy, which, great as it has always been pretty scattershot, is that we wanted to focus in on the things that we love the most. And that's why we're starting the A to Z of SFF. So we get to explore these things and hopefully do it in a way that's fun and entertaining.
Yes. Ultimately, we think it's a better listen for you, the listener, if it's short and pithy, and we're excited always to be talking about what we're talking about. It will mean that there will be less guests, but there will be a spot for guests, won't there, Rob?
Yeah, absolutely. If anyone's interested in appearing, then do drop us a line and we will make every effort to try and squeeze you in. We're talking about a very big subject here, even though I've been saying it's kind of reductive. It's not. Just talking about SFF is still a huge subject. If you've got any interest in anything around that, I mean, we're going very, very, very broad with this. You know, we're in the A's alone. You know, yes, we're talking Isaac Asimov, but we could also be talking about Gillian Anderson. We could also be talking about the Aphex Twin. You name it, there's a huge amount out there. So if you're interested in getting involved, let us know. We'd love to stick you
in
there.
And you would let us know by how?
Well, initially through the comments page on the A to Z of SFF.com. We will also have a Facebook page, which I'm guessing will be something like facebook.com/ the A to Z of SFF.
Indeed. And Twitter?
I haven't set that up yet.
We won't set that up, but
if
someone
Twitter
wants to tweet you,
well.
Rob, how do they do that?
You can tweet me directly. I'm twitter.com/ Conojito. That's Conojito.
So there you go, folks. That is the future. We're looking off into the future now. We had a lovely time, a fantastic time.
It's been a joy. Let's just
easy. And now it's time for our thank you, sir.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone that we've invited into the increasingly warm and sweaty Studio 2B. Thanks to Simon Aitken,
Maria Thomas,
Keith Isles, Neil Myers,
Chris Rogers,
how could we? Yeah, absolutely. Chris Rogers, what a guy.
Dominic Wade. The Little Unsaid, aka John Elliott.
Stuart Wright.
Mr. Graham Williams.
I think that's about it.
And apologies if we've missed anyone off. It's because we've been drinking.
Indeed.
Yeah, thank you so much for all of your help on the podcast and your contributions. We've loved having you on the podcast. We love chatting with you.
We really hope you've enjoyed what we've done over the last 18 months.
Thank you, listener. If you listen, whether you've just listened to this one podcast or whether you've been with us for the whole journey or whether you've just dropped in because you like music or you like film or you like comics and you cherry-picked those particular ones to listen to, thank you for joining us. We've loved having you.
You've been great. Speak to you soon.
Speak to you soon on the A to Z of SFF.
That's right. Sweet.